abuse, sexual abuse, is an absolute epidemic in this country. You know, and if anyone listening to this now has been abused, you know, I plead with them to please come forward and talk to others.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is John Saunders, chairman of one of the world's largest communications agencies, Fleischmann Hillard. He's originally from Artane in Dublin, but moved to London and then the United States after selling his PR company to the St. Louis agency in Missouri. Now he's back home to spend more time with his children and grandchildren and also to pursue his leisure interests like watching Everton Football Club. John, you are very welcome to the Insights podcast. We should probably start with a disclosure. We've been friends for very many years. We've been to family weddings and that kind of thing. You've had, I think it's true to say, a most interesting life and times, including topically, and we'll hear about it in a little while, an experience in Iran in that country's first international relations conference. But I'm just wondering, what is it like having been president and chief executive based at company headquarters for, what, 9, 10 years, and then it all ends? How do you adjust, or how have you been adjusting?
Well, I think it's really important to have a sense of who you are. You referenced at the top that I came from Artane, and I like to think, others may disagree, that I've always had a level of self-awareness. And when you do a job like I've been doing for the past decade, I think you're rather silly if you don't get it, that it will eventually come to an end. And I'm really good with that. I had a good innings, and I'm happy to be home. Because unlike a lot of people who go to work every day, whether it's on the train or the bus, for me, it was effectively on the plane. And while I was living in America for the best part of a decade and for 5 years in London before that, I was still very much anchored here to Ireland. So it's good to be back.
We're having this conversation as the American stroke Israeli war on Iran is in full flow. If you were back at your old job in St. Louis, I mean, what kind of things do you think you would be dealing with right now?
Well, it varies from the impact a war like this might have on many of our own staff. I mean, Fleischmann Hillard, for example, I mean, if you just by its name, we've always had a significant cohort of great colleagues who are from a Jewish background. And so the events of October the 7th a couple of years ago had and continue to have a seismic effect on that population within Fleischmann Hillard. So there's the internal audience. And of course, we also have hundreds of Muslims who are working in the business, and so you've that internal audience. Then you have how your clients are reacting, and then the advice that you give to your clients. And then we have clients who come from a very conservative background, others from a liberal background, and everybody, of course, has an opinion on this. So it's really always full on. I mean, over the years, like, we would trade in different parts of the world, and, you know, we were trading at a time, we were doing some business in Saudi Arabia, and that would cause a problem with, I remember getting a letter from, a very well-known congressperson, and about, you know, whether we were going to continue to work with Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, it changes. It always seems to change. Like, places like Saudi Arabia are in one time and then they're out or whatever. So trying to ride all those horses, if you like,
For instance, would it happen, say, at a moment like this, that some of your clients and your heavy hitting clients would be onto you to say, look, you know, you've got to get onto the administration, to Trump's people, and say, look, this thing can't go on for too long because, you know, we're hurting too much. There's too much at stake.
No, That would not happen. I mean, I think certainly, I mean, most of our major, not them all, but most of them would be American based, and I think that so many of them would be supporters of the current administration, and others wouldn't be. But I don't think they typically would not come to us to say, get onto the administration. I think a lot of those bigger companies in America would have fairly direct roots in themselves.
Let's go right back. Artane, growing up, you weren't the only one who was clever and ambitious in that area where you grew up, were you?
Well, growing up in Artane, first of all, it was my memories of it, that it was a delightful place. It was a lovely, community. Most of the men who lived around where we lived in a place called Brooked Lawn, which was actually a circle of 36, 37 houses. Most of the men would have worked in the civil service or Dublin Gas Company or the ESB. These were the typical jobs where people worked. And I say the men because growing up, of course, all the women were at home. Or if they had jobs in the civil service before they married, they had to give up those jobs. But there was something in the air in that part of the world where I think all the families were very much trying to do better. And many did extremely well. I mean, for example, two doors down were the O'Toole family, and Mary there, she later became a judge. And her brother, Andre, with Chris Horn, founded Iona Technologies. And next door to them lived Eamon Carr of Horselips fame. And then around the corner, I often remember at the weekends, my mother would send me to the shops and on Rosemont Avenue. And as I was going past one particular house, the box room upstairs, the window would be open and there would be a very noisy sound of drums coming from the window. And those drums were being played by a guy who's a couple of years younger than me called Larry Mullen. And I often walking past used to think, say to myself, would he ever get a life?
And sure enough, he did.
And sure enough, he did. And because within a year or two of that, the first ever performance of U2 was held in his kitchen. And my understanding, I think I have this right, is that Bono was interviewed for the band there in the kitchen, and he was there to play an instrument. But when he turned up, he said to Larry, "I don't play any instrument." And they kind of said, "Well, what do you do? Will you sing?" And it all came from that. But it was very much there. And of course, everybody around there continues to be very proud of Larry Mullen. And you know, his family were very much part of Artane. His dad only died a few years ago, but continued to live there.
And you yourself, you displayed an early interest in journalism, sports journalism, but it wasn't just that you were interested. You actually did something about it.
Well, I went to rugby school, but around it, where I lived in Artane, the big sporting interests were soccer, and by the early 70s, Gaelic football in particular had a renaissance, particularly with Dublin winning the All-Ireland in 1974 when I was 16. And I went to each of the games leading up to Dublin winning the All-Ireland final. And I remember it was also the time when I had alcohol for the first time, for the first game, I had 1 pint of Harp and Lime. And then by the time the final, I had 4 pints of Harp and Lime and was not in a great place to go to school the next morning. But I was very interested in soccer and League of Ireland soccer, which was going through a really bad time in the early 70s. And so I started a little magazine called Northside Football, which later became Irish football, and we got some very good guests at the time. I remember taking a half day from school in 1973. I think it was 14, it would have been 15, and interviewing George Best in the Gresham Hotel. And then I remember going over to Everton because in 74, their new manager, Billy Bingham, and we got the story, the headline we had in the magazine was, "I'd like to manage an All-Ireland team," says Billy Bingham. And given later on how people, particularly when he was manager of Northern Ireland against Ireland and thought he was very prejudiced against the Republic, back in 1974, in my little magazine, he said, "I'd like to manage an All-Ireland team."
And how did you sell it?
So there was myself and five other lads from around the area, and we got permission from the clubs to come and sell. They none of them had programs. So we would put in the centre of it, the squads for all the teams. And we sold it on the terraces at Talca Park and at Dalyman Park. And I remember when I was 14, inside the door at Talca Park meeting, because I asked him maybe would he mention it on RTE, meeting the great Jimmy McGee. And he subsequently then invited me in to be interviewed by him for a midweek program. And that was my first time ever on radio. And I'm very, from a personal point of view, proud to say that the very first interview I ever did on radio was conducted in the GPO. And that's a great memory to have. And I got a £10 fee for doing that. And, you know, Jimmy and like others were incredibly supportive of that initiative at the time. And of course, by having the magazine, I started getting to know players, but I also started getting to know journalists.
Among them, I think a particular mentor of yours was a man called David Guiney, who apparently had one of his claims to fame, aside from being an Irish Olympian, was that he was the first Irish journalist to earn £100 a week.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that. So Dave was at one point the sports editor of the Irish Press. And I think what you're referencing is he was headhunted by the Mirror group of newspapers, and he became the sports editor for the Sunday Mirror in Ireland. And Dave was terrific, and he was incredibly fair and decent to people. And I remember him telling me a story about when Frank O'Farrell was appointed the manager of Manchester United. The Mirror went absolutely crazy over this, and they wanted to find out people who had played football with Frank O'Farrell. And Dave said, I think it was a guy, I think I'm right in saying, called Tommy Moroney. I think he was from Cork. And Dave phoned Moroney, who was delighted to do the interview. And Dave said to Moroney, "No, you're not happy to do the interview." And he said, "Why not?" "Because you want money for the interview, don't you?" And the guy said, "No, I'll do it for nothing." But Dave kept saying to him, "No, you need money." And eventually Dave, at the time, got him £100 for this exclusive with the Sunday Mirror. And Dave was like that. He was a magnet for talent and just a magnet for people in general from all codes. And his home was, the door was always open to, I met people like Donny O'Sullivan from Kerry and the great Nicky Rackard and all kinds of other people. And they were wonderful friends of Dave. And Dave and the Guiney family were really good to me.
How did you start broadcasting?
Well, I started, first of all, doing as a stadium announcer at Talca Park for Home Farm. And then I was headhunted by Shamrock Rovers as the stadium announcer at Glenmalure Park, because they paid me £4 a game. And then I started doing the FAI international matches when I was still at school. And then I got a chance just after I left school to come in here to RTE to start doing some sub-editing. And when I was here doing some sub-editing, one day I noticed there was a whole gaggle of people around the radio centre, and I asked, what were they all here for? And it turned out for the first time in 7 years that the sports department were holding auditions. And I had never applied for an audition. So I asked somebody, is there any chance I could get one of those? And they said, sure, we'll stick you in. You know, I couldn't believe it. And they were being conducted by Philip Green, the late Philip Green, who was a famous sports commentator, who was all known by many people as well as Philip Green and White, because he was an avid Shamrock Rovers fan. So I decided to do my little 1 minute piece all about Shamrock Rovers. And I was one of seven out of the hundreds of people who Philip decided I had a voice good enough to go on air. And it didn't mean anything else. But because I was around the place, I eventually, my first piece on air was a cricket match between, I think, South Leinster and Mid Ulster, which I did in about 1977. I was 19.
And after that, then you went on to do, I think, sports bulletins in the morning. You did TV commentaries on Gaelic football matches and the rest.
Yeah, I mean, I was on the staff, and I like to think that I did reasonably well on radio and broke some good stories at different times. And then when later on, I'd left the staff, but I was still doing work here. And then on the television side, they thought that I might be useful as a Gaelic football commentator, which was a big mistake on their part and also a big mistake on my part. But I remember doing my first television commentary, which was a game between Cork and Armagh in Lurgan. And I travelled up with the late Tim O'Connor, who was the head of television sport, who made it very clear to me on the journey that he knew nothing about Gaelic football and was going to be of no help whatsoever to me. So when we got there, I also discovered that the director for BBC was also a director of Linfield Soccer Club. So it was clear that he didn't have any great insights on Gaelic football either. And this was a game in February, and it was the first game in many months after the closed season, if you like, in Gaelic football. And Cork came to the game with 12 new players. And this was going to be difficult. But when I went into the dressing room beforehand to get the players' names and everything like that, the final team selection, and as I was coming out, one of the Cork mentors said to me, "You've heard our news." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "We forgot our jerseys. So we're going to be playing in a borrowed set and there's no numbers on the back." So that was a very, that was a really big challenge. And I'm prepared to freely admit that I was not one of the great successes as a commentator, with the caveat that I was also an unlucky one.
Did you get another chance?
Oh, I did. I did. I got many more chances to dig a hole for myself. But it's like a lot of things. You know, people say you were a lousy commentator, and I was. But at least I can say I did it.
Working in the media wasn't entirely a new thing in your family. Your father was quite an accomplished or a renowned writer of stories through the Irish language. Cathal Sander, I think, was the name.
Yes, my late father was very prolific in the Irish language, and he at one stage he was working full time for the Government Publications Office on Goom, and he was contracted to write a book a month. And we don't know exactly the number of books he wrote, but it's in the region of 160 to 170. And the hero of many of his books is a detective called Rex Carlo. And it's wonderful that today there's an annual prize and for young Irish writing called Gradam Rex Carlo. And traditionally that award has been presented by the president annually. So his memory's been kept alive, and it's just terrific to see. And I think people recognise that it's unlikely there will be anybody else who will ever ever sell as many books as he sold in Irish. Again, we don't know in total, but probably around 500,000 books.
At what stage, John, did you decide to concentrate on public relations or public affairs? You went out on your own, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, throughout my teens, all I wanted to do was to be a journalist. And I got to follow that dream. And then coming into RTE was an absolute dream. And being back here today still gives me goosebumps and puts the hair on the back, whatever hair I've left on the back of my neck, standing up. And I loved being here. And here had a very positive influence on me. And I feel honoured and privileged to have worked in RTE. But I, first of all, I felt that in order to be what I wanted to be in broadcasting, I would have needed to move beyond sport. And on the one hand, being here when I was so young, and I remember I came into RTE when I was barely 19, and I was on air at the time, I was 19, and this was before 2FM, and there was hardly anybody, certainly on air, who was under 30. So I was kind of almost a generation apart from everybody. So there was a real confidence issue. While I was comfortable doing the bulletins and everything like that, I didn't have the confidence, really. I didn't have the self-confidence to go on and do anything more here. And I was interested in the broader area of communications.
Actually, before you go on to talk about that, sure. I meant to ask you, John, you did get a break on television as a result of Jim Carney, the first presenter, I think, of the Sunday Game. He had a bad car crash and there was an opening for you.
Yeah, Jim is a great guy. And there was going to be a new program on television, a young people's program called Let's Go. And I was going to be a reporter on it. And Kathy Park was going to be the female presenter of it. They wanted somebody who came from a PE background, and she was fulfilling that role. And then Jim was going to be the main presenter in studio. Unfortunately, a month or two before the program came on air, he had a terrible car accident, I think, on his way home to Galway. And then I was asked to step in. So I did that program every Tuesday evening. It went out at 5:30 on RTE1. And that was really interesting to do, and you know, we had some great guests on the program. But part of my role was to get the guests in studio every week, and I knew by then I knew a lot of the people. Like, we had Eamon Coughlin in, we Tony Ward in, I got Pelle in, and every week we produced somebody really, really top class sports person. But one of the issues that was happening for me was that I was now getting recognized everywhere I went and on the street, and that was something that I was not that comfortable. I'd love it now, but I was not that comfortable with it. And
so eventually, anyway, you decided that you weren't making the kind of progress you wanted to make in broadcasting.
Yes, that's true. But while I was here, there were a number of people had approached me about going into public relations. I mean, the late Bill O'Hurley kindly asked me would I join his firm. Others asked me, and then one of the leading advertising agencies in Dublin at the time, they said they were going to start a PR arm, and would I head it up? And that was the difference. It was about that interested me, the idea of heading it up. And I'm not sure. I think I was 22 or 23 at the time, and I left the staff then, having been on staff for maybe two to three years, and I left, and that's when I went into the PR business full time.
How did that develop then?
Well, that particular job didn't last that long. It was about a year, and then we had a parting of the ways, although I remain grateful to O'Connor Sullivan for that opportunity. And then I went into another partnership which lasted 8 or 9 years. And in the course of being there at that time, then we got an opportunity to work for Anheuser-Busch, the brewers of Budweiser. And that introduced me to the whole world of public relations in America. And I always loved America. I was very excited by the energy of America. So that whole time then, when I was 26, 27, was really pivotal in my career, because as it transpired, the agency for Anheuser-Busch, the Brewers of Budweiser, which was by far and away the biggest selling beer in the world at that time, and in America in the mid-80s, almost one in two of every beer sold was an Anheuser-Busch product. So they dominated the market. They had massive budgets for marketing. And their PR firm was a company based out of St. Louis, which was also the headquarters of Anheuser-Busch. Their PR firm was a company called Fleischmann Hillard. And that's was a huge moment for me.
And your first connection with them, if I remember rightly, was with the Irish Derby. It became the Budweiser Irish Derby.
That's correct. I was driving back to the office one day and I was listening to the 145 Sports News on 2FM, and Roy Willoughby came on and announced that from next year the Irish Derby, which had been known as the Irish Sweeps Derby from, I think, 1962 to 1986 or 85, that from next year, 1986, will be known as the Budweiser Irish Derby. And when I got into the office, I called him because I was really surprised at this announcement. And I said, you know, where did this come from? And he said, it's unusual. It was announced, came in on the wires from New York. And so I phoned then a very famous broadcaster, sports announcer in America called Don Crickey, who was a friend of mine. I asked him, did he know anything about this announcement? He said no. But he said, I'm very familiar with the top people at Anheuser-Busch. Call this gentleman, called Mike Rorty, who was the head of marketing at Anheuser-Busch. So I phoned him, and their office then directed me to this company called Fleischmann Hillard. And that was my first time ever talking to Fleischmann Hillard. And they told me they'd already hired a PR firm in Ireland. I asked them which firm, and they told me, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I thought this firm was not at all suited for this work, this type of work. And so over the next few months, I would send the people in America news clippings about the beer industry in Ireland, about sponsorship in Ireland. And 6 months later, they called me and said, it hasn't worked out with our agency, and we're going to be holding a competition this time with different agencies pitching for our business, and would you like to pitch for it? And we did, and we won it.
And how long did that relationship last? In other words, specifically about the Derby.
Well, the Derby, I think in the end, they sponsored the Derby for over 20 years or so. But it was really at its zenith for the first 9 or 10 when the Americans were really running it. And they did an amazing job. And they put very significant resources behind it. And for a time, the Budweiser Irish Derby became one of the richest horse races in the world. And they brought over lots and lots of celebrities, and, you know, people like Paul Newman were there, and lots of other famous actors and actresses came in at different times.
I was looking at your company's websites, or various ones that are examples of them, last evening, and it says, at the core of the Fleischmann Hillard philosophy is the power of true. It goes on to talk about respect, teamwork and ethical behaviour, transparent business practices. Now, does that present problems to you about the kind of clients you would take on, or clients that, you know, you would have doubts about whether you want to keep them or not?
Well, first of all, I say anybody in Fleischmann Hillard, when they've just heard that question, will be laughing, because power of true was an expression that my predecessor, who is a good friend of mine, he was the person who adopted that. And as soon as I became CEO, I dropped it. So power of true is not something that we've used in the last 10 years. But yes, I mean, people in journalism often think that people in PR have little or no integrity. And that may well be true in some cases, just like in every other walk of life. But you know, who we work for is important. But also, we've always given individuals the right to say, I don't want to work on that particular piece of business.
There was a period, I think a 7-year period, when Fleischmann Hillard, I don't know where you were in the architecture of the company at this stage, acted for the Tobacco Institute in the United States. That's an umbrella body for cigarette manufacturers. Mm. Now, how does that sit with ethical behaviour?
That's must be a very long time ago. And certainly I was not around, and I'm not sure when it was, but it was a very long time back. The company made a decision not to work for tobacco companies.
I want to ask you as well, John, about a controversy much closer to us here in Europe. 6 or 7 years back, Le Monde, the French newspaper, got hold of a document known as the Monsanto file. Basically, it was consisted of profiles drawn up by Fleischmann-Hillard executives on over 200 journalists, politicians, scientists, and others likely to influence debate on glyphosate, I think is the yes. pronunciation of the word. It's got to do with that weed killer Roundup that was promoted by Monsanto. Now, you took a bit of, I don't mean you personally, but the company took a bit of a hit on that one.
Well, working for Monsanto was always challenging because the whole debate around products like Roundup engenders great emotion and controversy. And on the one hand, there's a huge body of work and people as well who I admire and trust who would say that the future of, if you're looking at feeding a global population of nearly 10 billion, then the only way that we're going to be able to do it is by using genetically modified crops. But in relation to the specific issue, I mean, our view at the time and continues to be that all that we did was, well, if you like, a compendium of information that was already in the public domain. And we were fully exonerated at that time, Fleischmann-Hillard, in terms of our involvement. But it was a tough time.
I think Bayer, your clients, brought in a legal firm to look at everything that was contained in that, and they said, look, you had done nothing illegal. But as against that, I think the former French Environment Minister, Ségolène Royal, said, look, this was about silencing strong voices and, in her case, to isolate her.
Well, there's always differing issues between privacy laws here in Europe and also differing views in the United States. But certainly our firm was never in the business of silencing anyone. And to this day, one of our most important offices we have is in Brussels, and it's massively respected within the institutions in Brussels. But I, you know, that issue was rather less about us and entirely about the particular products you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, the other thing, and this is the last point on this one, it was reported that the fee for the contract was 14.5 million euro, which was way above what was actually declared by the both companies to the EU's Transparency Centre.
Well, we've always been compliant with all those European laws, and we've never ever fallen foul of anything whatsoever to do with the European Union. And again, as I say, the office in Brussels is massively respected to this day. We are nothing but a well-regarded firm in Brussels and elsewhere.
I suppose issues arise all the time that present problems in terms of how you deal with them. I'm thinking particularly now of another area that's maybe a bit more sensitive in the States now than it was previously, particularly since the changeover from, say, the Democrat presidents to Donald Trump being in the White House. And that's the whole area of equality, diversity and inclusion. I mean, that was something which I think you took very seriously. I don't know if you still take it very seriously, but you certainly engaged with it during your time as president and chief executive.
Well, I think, you know, DE&I has, I think, continues to be it's a very big issue in many countries. It's a particular problem in the United States because of its history. And then in the wake of the murder of George Floyd a number of years ago, there was a very big move then to make significant progress in a way that maybe hadn't been done since the days of the halcyon days of the civil rights movement. And there was a big onus on companies to have quotas and so on. And Fleischmann-Hillard, we've been very active in that space. And even today, we have a higher percentage of people from minorities in the United States working in the firm than we've ever had. But clearly, the Trump administration takes a very different view on it. And the rules and regulations in the United States have changed. And it now makes it illegal to have quotas. And so it's different. But I still think that there's a real issue there and that goes back into history. My own view is that America still has a lot of work to do in that space. I think that companies like ours will continue to find ways in which we can embrace and include people who come from minorities.
Was there a time when you had quotas and found yourself hiring people who maybe weren't quite up to the job?
Well, I think that what happened in the aftermath of the George Floyd killing, there was such an outcry, and then there was such a movement throughout America to rectify perceived wrongs. But I think that in making those corrections, there were overcorrections made. And I think that helped feed in to belief of Republicans or those who, like President Trump and others, who believed it went too far. And yes, I do think there were situations where people were taken on in different companies who maybe weren't qualified for the role. So there were definitely mistakes made.
Did you make a few yourself?
Absolutely. I made some mistakes. But overall, I'm very happy with the journey that we embarked on. And I continue to believe that we had right on our side. I mean, in many situations, you were dealing with African-Americans who were trying to get into our business, who was not, nobody in their family had ever worked in the area of marketing. Nobody in their family had ever worked in an area of service. And I remember talking to one young chap who had worked with us and who it had not worked out for. And I remember him telling me afterwards, he contacted me afterwards, something I'd written. And he said that the most difficult part was not the job, but it was at the water cooler, was when people were talking about their weekends and playing tennis or the clubs they were members of. He was left out of all those conversations. And so that was a lesson we learned, and we all worked much harder. And I can remember at one point, along the way, me saying to one of my colleagues that, you know, I have never been in my life, I've never been to a black person's home, for example. And then they changed that. I remember going up and spending a weekend in New Jersey with a pastor, a Lutheran pastor who is African American. I spent a weekend in his home and with his flock and going to his church and having dinner and spending a whole weekend where I was the only white face. And the only time I saw a white face was when I looked in the mirror. And I found that incredibly stimulating. But, you know, I would say for many American white people, that's an experience they would never have.
You mentioned earlier on in our conversation, John, that a lot of the people that would have been clients of yours or the companies, they would be, I suppose, you know, comprising largely of folks who would be well disposed towards Donald Trump. Now, on this side of the Atlantic, it's almost something that's just not done in polite company for people to admit in any sense that they would be Trump supporters, Trump admirers, and all the more so in view of recent events and developments in the Middle East. How do you read the differences in perception of politics and the political actors in the States as compared to in Europe?
Well, I think first of all, you have to go slightly behind that. And one of the things that I learned, it took me a little while, but when I went to live in America, was to stop looking at America through my Irish eyes. In the same way that we criticize at times Americans for how they look upon Ireland. So in going there, I feel really lucky that I ended up living in St. Louis, because St. Louis is right in the center of America. So if you were living in New York or San Francisco, both of those places would tend to be much more in line with our kind of Irish sensibilities, whereas St. Louis often is not, and has a different view of the world. So it's really important to understand that so many Americans think fundamentally differently from Irish people. America is a very complex place. Somebody said to me a couple of years ago, always remember it's called the United States of America. And in many ways, it's just as diverse as the European Union. People often don't fully appreciate that. So people living in a state where I lived in Missouri, often they think profoundly differently to people who are, as I said, live on the East Coast or the West Coast. So by the time Donald Trump came to be elected, while it was a huge surprise here to people in Ireland that he was elected, it was not much of a surprise to me. I mean, I remember Jean, my wife, and myself, we were invited. It was a great honor. We were traditionally one of the presidential debates takes place in Washington University in St. Louis. And so we were invited to the second of the three presidential debates. And there was only an audience of 600 or 700. And we were kind of placed in a neutral zone, but just bordering with the Republican supporters. And we were chatting to people there ahead of the debate, and it was charming, and we had a lovely evening, and everybody was wonderful. And we were sitting beside these young people. And at a moment in the debate where Donald Trump said to Hillary Clinton, when I'm president, I'll put you in jail, everybody beside us leapt up and started cheering. And all these people that we'd had these delightful conversations were saying, you nailed her, you got her. And
Lock her up became the challenge.
And it was fascinating to be there and realize, oh wow, you know, these people they love Donald Trump.
You were Grand Marshal for the St. Patrick's Day Parade in St. Louis. What was that like?
That was a great thrill and a great honor, and to be accepted as an Irish American, if you like, over there. And you know, St. Louis has a proud history and association with Ireland. You know, back in the day, not just did it have an Irish quarter, it even had a Kerry quarter in the place. And it still has one of the biggest and St. Patrick's parades. And I really loved it. It was a great honour.
Part of your job was to give lectures, to give talks, to participate in symposiums of various kinds. Tell me about the time you went to Iran.
So I was invited to Iran around about 2004. And I accepted the invitation because there was a growing view at that time that Iran was beginning to open up. I don't think that that really happened. And so I went with a number of others were invited as well. And it was described as the first international PR conference of Iran. And it was a grand event. It was a big auditorium, very impressive. It was so much so that the event went out live on Iranian television, which doesn't say a lot for their schedule. The then mayor of Tehran, Ahmadinejad, he came to the event, and I spoke there, and that's a great memory. I remember at the start of my presentation, and it was the auditorium was incredibly impressive. I remember at the start they announced, which I've never experienced before or since, they said the event is a sellout, and we have 1,000 men here and we have 250 women. But that's the way it was presented. And then when I got up to speak, my opening slide was a photograph of myself, and I asked the audience, what do you think of him? Would you say, does he come from England? Does he come from America? Would you like him? Would you dislike him? And I ask questions like this. And I said, while you're considering that, let me tell you what I see. So where the part of the world that I come from, I'm looking at 1,250 terrorists.
What put that notion into your head?
Well, because my conference was all about stereotypes and perceptions and about the need to get beyond that. And letting people in Iran know how they were being perceived elsewhere and what were they up for in terms of trying to change that. But actually, much to my surprise, as soon as I said it, I got a standing ovation because they all accepted, yeah, that's exactly how we're perceived. Like, the people I met over the few days that I was in Tehran, they were massively intelligent. Most of the people seemed to come from Tehran University. They were engaged, they were utterly charming. I remember at one stage saying to a group, I said, you've just been put on the axis of evil by President Bush, and how do you feel about that? And I remember one of them saying, listen, we don't pay any more heed to President Bush than we do to our own leaders. So they had a great sense of black humor and irony that I didn't expect to find.
Over the course of your career, John, you've got several accolades, but I would surmise, I could be wrong about this, that the one that perhaps meant most to you was a couple of years ago in Dublin City University. You mightn't have gone to college, but you got the honorary doctorate from them.
Yeah, I when I got that phone call, I was completely blown away. And if I had gone to college, I think DCU would have been the place for me. And of course, coming from Martain, the fact that it's physically located on the north side, but it wasn't there. It hadn't started when I left school.
I'd imagine you get an opportunity, or they haul you in to give talks or work with their students, maybe in the communication, stroke journalism area. What kind of things do you tell them?
Generally, I'm not talking about specifically about communication. It's more about resilience. It's more about the knocks you take. It's and more about leadership and the various stages of your career that you go through. I mean, when we're all starting out, and we talked earlier on about me being in here, and if you think of it as, you know, when I was doing the sports news, age 19, when I would go home every day, my father would have recorded me and I was able to listen back and sort of critique myself. And so that stage of your life, when you've come out of college or come out of school and everything, you're trying to figure your way in the world. And by definition, it's very much about me, and it needs to be about me. And then as you move through your career, say in RTE, that you become somebody becomes a producer, and then they are looking after various presenters, or think of any other area of life where you have responsibility for others, and then you move from it being about me to how you behave is all about us. It's about thinking about others, the welfare of others. And then there's a third stage for people like me, where I got to has been CEO of the firm, where it's about everybody else except me. And it's about, in order for the organization to thrive, you've got to be motivating all the others around you and trying to ensure that everybody has the tools in order to do their job. So there's all these stages. So I think where I can add some value at occasions is to be able to talk about those phases, but also to be able to talk about, you talked about earlier about clients, why we've won hundreds and thousands of clients over the years. We've also lost hundreds and thousands of pitches. And in most rooms that I'm ever in, nobody has lost more than I've lost. But you have to learn how to lose in order to eventually have to win.
Finally, John, coming right back to your family, and no matter how well you do in, professional or business life, there's always the family, and you provide for them, but you can't protect them from everything. And I know in your case, you've got two very brave daughters, Hannah and Caroline, and they spoke publicly about something that I think, came as a massive shock to you and your wife, Jean, and to your family?
Well, you're right in saying that Caroline and Hannah have both spoken publicly. I've never spoken publicly about it before, but I will. So back in 2013, Caroline had got married. In fact, you and Caroline were at the wedding. And Caroline had a wonderful job teaching in a very famous school in London, St. Paul's Girls' School in Hammersmith, doing really well. Within a short period of time, her life seemed to fall apart. And she was not able to go in and teach. And to be quite honest, I just couldn't understand what was going on with her. And, you know, this girl has everything, it seems. Great husband, great family, great job. And, you know, what the hell is going on here? Then she became quite unwell, and she overdosed on two occasions. As I understand it, the second time in particular, we are very lucky that she survived. She was taken to hospital by ambulance. But we had no idea whatsoever about what was going on. And I always remember I was in Moscow at some meetings, and I got a call from Caroline saying that I need to talk to you. And I said, I'm in Moscow. I'll be back on Friday. This would have been Tuesday. I'll be back on Friday. Will that work? And she said, I really need to talk to you before then. So I said, okay, I'll get on the next plane that I can get on. And I came home and we met her in London. Jean came over in our flat in London. And it was an absolute harrowing meeting, of where she told us that she had been systematically abused from a very, very young age, for a period over many, many years, by somebody who was very close to our family. It was a very dark, difficult time for all of us. But of course, for Caroline as the victim, it was particularly horrendous for her, but it was her telling us was the first step on another journey, for want of a better expression. We talked to Caroline or Hannah at the time and asked her had anything happened to her, and she said no, and she didn't want to discuss anything, and she wasn't forthcoming until about at least another year. And then we discovered that she too had been abused over many, many years. So we've gone through a whole period of the family of dealing with that, trying to come to terms with it. Everybody deals with these situations like this in a different way. But we've got to a point now where, you know, as you described, the girls, their bravery. And one of the consequences of all of this is that in Caroline and Hannah going public in the way that they have and doing podcasts and various interviews, it has been extraordinary the number of young and not so young people who've come forward and said, I have never told anybody, but this is as a result of reading your story or hearing your story, I am now going to tell people that how I was abused. And hundreds of people have come forward. And it is very clear that abuse, sexual abuse, is an absolute epidemic in this country. an absolute epidemic. And there are people to this day who are you know, and if anyone listening to this now has been abused, you know, I plead with them to please come forward and talk to others. It will change your life. Please don't keep this as a secret, because the more it's kept as a secret, the perpetrators, they're the people who win. So it was very tough. And of course, you know, not long after all of this, I was going off to work in America as well. But it was really tough. But it's also a lesson that you just never know what's going on behind people's doors.
And I'm wondering as well, John, because I don't know any parents who were as dedicated to their kids as you and Jean. And, you know, would there have been, you must have spent some time racking your brains. Was there something we should have spotted? Was there something we missed? You know, is there anything in that area that, you know, you would say to people, you know, God, if I'd only seen or cottoned on to whatever?
Sean, I will take to my grave that question and that massive shortcoming. And it is a key question, and it's a very fair question as to what did you see? And I can sit here and hold my hand on my heart and say, I never saw anything. Mm. And not only did we not see anything, we encouraged our children to be with the particular individual. Never saw anything, never suspected anything. And I've gone back in my mind hundreds and thousands of times, as indeed has Jean, and we were never aware of anything. And the cover up and the manipulation was done to an extraordinary extent. And of course, as happens in some of these in so many of these stories and these situations, the perpetrator not only have they physically and violently abused children, they've also frightened the hell out of them to an extent that they don't tell, they don't say anything.
Thank you so much indeed for joining me for this conversation. So insightful, so open. Thank you, John.
Sean, thank you.
And if you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this podcast, especially towards the end, please visit rte.ie/helplines. And you can find more insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RTE Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening.